podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
What makes for a great vacation? Depends on who you ask. Are you looking to get away? Or bring everyone together? Do you want to get outside and play? Or see a play at the plate? Fortunately, however you operate, I'm the destination you've been looking for. The name's Missouri, but you can call me Mo. And I have just one question. What's your MO? To find your MO, tap now. Or for information on safe travel, come see me at visitmo.com.
It is the Blue Room. It is your weekly show here on a Thursday. Not long until the Toffees are in action again against Wolves, whether you're looking forward to that or not. We'll have to wait and see, I suppose. But we are here because there's been a lot going on at Everton this week. Obviously, some very sad news, a poor performance. And of course, we'll speak about a few other different things as well. But joining me to get started off today, Les Roberts. Les, how are you, mate?
Not recovered from Watford, unfortunately. Can't shake it out of my head. I was speaking to someone today about it, and I genuinely think it's the worst game I've ever been to. Just, I don't know if that's sort of recency bias, because I've seen some absolute shockers, but I just think we'll get into it in a bit later, but the manner of the defeat, the team it was against, when we've been leathered in the past, it's generally been against decent sides. Apart from maybe like West Brom and Bolton, who've done us a couple of times with by a similar scoreline, but I just really can't shake it because we were speaking earlier in the season, this seemed like a sustainable run we were on. And then suddenly we've got this issue where we can't deal with free kicks and corners, and the team capitulates under a little bit of pressure. So now we've got a whole new set of issues that we've not had for a couple of seasons at least.
Yeah, it's one of those games where you just sort of going about your day, not thinking about it, and then all of a sudden you're just like, oh, Watford.
It's PTSD, it's PTSD like Newcastle. Honestly, yeah. This has got to affect us for years to come. This.
Oh, dearie me. We will speak about that a little bit later on. We're also going to speak about the 1986-87 Everton team that won the title and is very much a forgotten side in our history. And the man who's just finished a book about that team, it's out now, Paul McPartland. Paul, how are you, mate?
Yeah, fine, Matt. Thanks for the introduction. And I mentioned the book as well. And I feel exactly the same as Les. It was a totally dispiriting, depressing experience on Saturday, all the more so because it was quite unexpected. And I actually brought myself before the show today to go back and watch the highlights again on Match of the Day. And it was actually worse than I remember it. It was everything that could go wrong did go wrong. And I've seen better positional play from a schoolboy 11. It was absolutely abysmal in that collapse in the second half. And I think as Les has mentioned quite rightly there, it does leave you speculating as to where we go from here, because there's no obvious replacements to come in for the side that we had there at the weekend. And it's a worrying time, the Blues, at the moment. And, I don't know about you two, but I'm actually dreading the derby game in December.
Oh, God, yeah. I'm not even thinking about it. It's well out of my mind for the time being. We all talk about Watford a little bit later. We'll talk about Paul's book a little bit later as well. But we have got to start off, lads, with some sad news this week. It was confirmed earlier on in the week that Walter Smith had died. Obviously, former Everton manager, legend of Scottish football, and it's been so many heartfelt and excellent tributes to him. I'm glad I've got you both on, really, because I was speaking to Alan and Adam Jones in the week on Subs Weekly, and they're even younger than me, so I think Walter was certainly before their time. It was just sort of when I was starting to get into football, Les, that I was becoming conscious of Everton and the players and the manager. And I remember when we got him in, that my dad was like, this fella's been to Rangers and he's won all sorts. He's gonna take us everywhere. He's gonna take us back to the top. And I'm not gonna be revisionist when I sit here and say, I remember him coming home and going, oh my word, that was dreary. That was horrible. Some of the football was grim. But I've spoken to you about this time period a lot, and you've said that it was probably the time in your life where you were going the match and you were. Was free-spirited, would that be the best way to put it? So
that's a nice way of putting it.
So he's certainly somebody who was probably a big figure in your life at a time you remember well. But first and foremost, what are your memories of the man himself when he was at Everton?
He always came across as a very dour manager with dour football, didn't he? He sort of came in with this reputation from Rangers because he won the lot up there multiple times over. And he came across as that. But I've been listening to a few things in the last week. We had Dave Prentice talking about him. He was just saying he really wasn't like that in real life. he was a funny, really personable fella, but he had this sort of veneer, basically, as a manager, whereby he just looked no-nonsense and he just sort of, this is how he did things and that's how it's done. And you can't think of Walter Smith without thinking of Archie Knox and Archie Knox's baseball bat. That was like a legendary thing around Belfield, apparently. But I think he's never going to go down as one of the greatest ever managers or even one of anyone's favourites. But I think you've got to look at it in context to what he did. He came in on the back of one of the worst seasons ever. Howard Kendall's third season, that's one of the worst Everton teams I think I've ever seen. It was an absolutely appalling season. So he came in and had to sort out that mess. He also had to work with Peter Johnson, which I don't think anyone would envy that position. And he should, if nothing else, his legacy should be that he was the manager that got rid of Peter Johnson. Because a lot of managers would have walked when Duncan Ferguson got sold. He didn't. I think he was thinking about it, definitely, because you would do if, you know, one of your best assets had just been sold from under your nose.
Yeah.
But he didn't. He stuck to it and he got Peter Johnson out. And I don't think that can really be underestimated, how much sort of drive that must have taken from him, really stick with this job and I'm going to get rid of the chairman, because it was a case of then it was the manager or the chairman, one of them had to go. Thankfully, Peter Johnson went. It didn't really end well for Walter Smith, but I think the job he did was he set it up for David Moyes. So he sort of got us from like a real relegation fodder, probably to a reasonable mid-table team. You know, we look at, like, you think back to the Tranmere defeat and you think back to Middlesbrough defeat when he actually went after that one, I think it was. And we've been doing that for years. It doesn't matter who our manager is. We pull results like that out in any decade with any manager. But I think he definitely sort of built the foundations to which David Moyes then took on and had that, the relative success there. I think the problem with Everton since then is that the manager after David Moyes, Roberto Martinez, and no subsequent managers have really built on those foundations, and it's all fallen apart again. But yeah, it's, you know, he was a big character in Everton's history. And even though we weren't very good, and sometimes we played with just, like, it seemed 10 centre-backs on the pitch, some of my most enjoyable days of going to watch Everton, they really were good. Good times to be going to the pub before the game and after, I'll say that.
What about you, Paul? What are your memories of Walter and his Everton charge?
Yeah, I mean, pretty similar to what Les outlined there. I mean, I think from my perspective, I always found Smith a real mixed bag, because there were some really good elements about him. I think he, as Les outlined there, the season before when we were nearly relegated under Kendall, and I think we'd gone down that season, I don't think we would have come back. To me, that was always a more important season than the Wimbledon game, because the club was in such a cold state then. He stabilised the club. He brought in some really good signings at the start, like from Marco Materazzi, Olivier Decaux, John Collins. And then, you know, there was the debacle with PC Johnson, as Mr. Spuddles' business was draining all his money. And suddenly, because of the loss he made of Mr. Spuddles, he had to give up his leadership of Everton, which kind of worked in our favour a little bit.
You've got to explain that one, I think, Paul, to people who may be overseas and may not get that reference.
Well, I mean, Jones was known by the Everton fans as Hamperman, because he was into sort of the food distribution business, and he branched out into a new trendy line trying to attract the younger markets who were enticed by hampers called Mr. Spuddles, which is like this flavoured sort of weird type crisp product that he kind of thought was going to revolutionise the eating habits of teenagers. It failed dismally. No one bought it. All the money he ploughed into it actually took away from his business. In the end, he had to give up. I think it was part of the reason why he relinquished control of Everton, because all the money he'd lost on Mr. Spuddles, I think, basically was subsidised by Duncan Ferguson going to Newcastle. Yeah. But I mean, the whole Mr. Spuddles thing was just bizarre. But I mean, Walter Smith here, a couple of things about him. I mean, I think young players didn't prosper under Smith. We had some really promising players at that time, Franny Jeffers, Michael Ball, Danny Cadamateri, who all at various stages fell out with Smith. He had a predilection for bringing in ageing footballers who were well past their best. Paul Gascoigne, Mark Hughes. And what did it for me? When he signed David Ginola in the January of his last season, I couldn't see any future for Smith if that was the path we were going down. I think as well that he had a fascination with centre-half. He seemed to buy a centre-half every season. It was either Alan Stubbs or Richard Goff or David Weir. I think one season he bought three centre-halves in. So it was a real mixed bag. And the football, as Les outlined there at times was dire. I mean, there were some great games. I went to the West Ham game when we beat them 4-0 at Upton Park. Nick Barmby scored a hat-trick, and it was one of the best displays of football I'd ever seen. But I vividly remember at the end of the game, Everton had to argue amongst themselves about whether Smith was the answer or not. You know, some were saying, no, this is a one-off. Others saying, no, you've got to give the guy a chance. And he had spells of bringing players in, and then he disappeared. Like Joe Max Moore appeared, scored about 9 goals in about 10 games, and never heard of again, just disappeared completely out of the club. So it was quite a strange leadership of the club at the time. And going back to what Les was saying there about the Tranmere game, I think the Tranmere game is on par with the Watford game because it was a side littered with ex-Everton players, Paul Vidal, Gary Stevens, Pat Nevin as well, I think, who played us off the park that day. And, you know, when you're getting beat at home by a lower league derby rival 3-0 and played off the park, then I think it was serious questions have to be asked. When Johnson appointed Bolton Smith, he said at the time, I'm bringing a world-class manager to Goodison. We got a decent manager. We never got a world-class manager in Bolton Smith.
I think in amongst all that, Paul, and I'll come straight back to you on that, I think is, you know, seeing the stuff we've seen about him this week and, you know, in regards to how he carried himself and the class he had, I suppose, to maintain that, you know, seeing the story that Bill Kenwright told about him, that after he had the conversation that he was getting the boot by Everton effectively, that Smith said, right, who are we going to get in next then to take this club forward? And, you know, I'm sure Bill likes to embellish these things a little bit, doesn't he? But, you know, I think to maintain that sort of dignity and that level of grace about you at Everton when, as Les mentioned, there's so much going on with Johnson, there's so much going on with the team, you know, there were aging players coming in, you know, that's a feat in itself, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's no question about the integrity of the man. I don't think there's any question about the caliber of the man. I think the question always has been, what was he like as Everton manager? And not being selfish, as an Everton fan, I judge him what he did for Everton. So he was there for 4 seasons. He never finished once in the top half under Walter Smith. Now, there's different explanations for that, I'm sure. And you can make a good case for the defence. And I think as well, in terms of how he dealt with the media, how he managed Everton's reputation in the media, I think he did a good job there. But you know, if you're being hard and cynical, at the end of the day, you know, he stabilised the club, but he never really looked like taking us to the next level. And I still think some of our young, that crop of players who's coming through, Franny Jeffers, Michael Ball, Danny Cadamateri, we never ever really developed them. And I think, you know, we that's been a problem with Everton for a number of years now.
Yeah, still a problem to this day, isn't it? And just finally on this, Les, as well, of course, he brought Kevin Campbell to the football club and was very much the man in charge in our last win at Anfield in front of a crowd, wasn't he? So, you know, I think obviously the situation where we had to bring Campbell in to save us is one of our own making, but getting that fella through the door at Everton was a masterstroke, really, wasn't it?
Yeah, I remember when we signed Kevin Campbell, I wasn't really into it at all because he'd not been brilliant at Arsenal. He was away in Turkey, and I remember thinking, this fella's not going to get us out of it. I just didn't think he was that good. And then he turned up at Everton, and he was absolutely outstanding, and obviously became the player we all know and love now. I think it was one of those things where Kevin Campbell was the right fit for Everton at the time, and the two things just went brilliantly. But yeah, full credit to Walter Smith for actually identifying Kevin Campbell as the answer and it actually working. Just one thing on spuddles. Do you know what spuddle actually means? It's a proper word. It means to make a lot of fuss about trivial things as if it were important.
Wow. You should be a countdown list.
There you go.
There you go. Goes perfectly hand in hand with Everton, that, doesn't it?
I'm mega impressed with that. Mega impressed.
No, Paul, he's got a computer in front of him. You can just Google it. I don't think you knew that one off the top of his head, did you, Les?
I did know it actually meant something, though.
There you go. I'm looking forward to you using that in a sentence in future podcasts. But no, lovely words from the lads there on Walter Smith. And of course, we do send our best wishes out to his family and what is no doubt going to be a difficult time for them. We will move on now. Obviously, it feels a little bit inconsequential to talk about football, but that is ultimately what we're here to do. And we have got to talk about what happened on Saturday at Goodison Park. But, you know, we all briefly touched upon it in the intro there, Les, you said it's the worst game you've ever been to, I think you said, or one of the least you've ever enjoyed. You know, I've seen us melt down against Wigan. I've seen us melt down against West Brom. We did it a few weeks ago at Aston Villa, but nothing quite compares to that. And, you know, I think on the post-match we did, I was sort of in a, you know, you're in the pub with your mate, you're sort of just like, oh my God, can you believe us, how bad we are? And we all sort of tried to get through it by laughing at it and try to bring levity to the situation. But, No, I think like Paul said there, watching the highlights and seeing the goals back and seeing clips on Twitter, seeing stills of opposition on Twitter, I feel like I'm more angry right now talking about it again than I am when I took a step out of Goodison Park and I was just laughing at my head off at how we were playing.
I think I walked out the ground laughing with the kids, thinking, what the hell has just happened there? Walking out, there were rumours circulating that he'd scored a fifth because I didn't even hear it. Fifth gone in. But yeah, it was... We have seen some terrible results and terrible capitulations, but I think the thing that worried me most about that one was the way the players lost their heads. Now, there were a lot of things Benitez got wrong in that game. I think the main thing was that he seemed to want to go to score more when we went 2-1 up.
Whereas, do you think so?
Because I don't think he made the midfield. He brought Iwobi on, didn't he? And if he'd have brought maybe Gbamin on, sort of just shore up the midfield, I think it was a very attacking substitution, really.
I think I think the substitution almost worked too quick for him. If that makes sense. Like, we scored and we had all these attacking players on the pitch.
Yeah.
And then he sort of looked behind him, said, right, who can I bring on to, you know, shore us up here? Gbamin, who obviously doesn't trust, Holgate, who he obviously doesn't fancy. And that's it, really.
Yeah.
There is literally nobody else that he's going to look to. So I think it was this weird situation where I didn't see us go and try and press and harry and win it back and get on the front foot to score another goal. I just saw us try and get in a shape and stifle them, but without the players necessarily to play that way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, but I mean, either way, the worrying thing I was going to say was that the players lost their heads. No matter what mistakes he made with any substitutions or formation or anything like that, you really can't legislate for when your players do that. If you're stood there on the sideline and you are watching some international players scrambling after the ball like kids in the playground, there's really not a great deal you can do. Paul's a braver man than me because I haven't watched it back at all. What was the one where Michael Keane got dragged right over?
Oh, that was the third, wasn't it?
Third goal is burned on my retinas because I just remember looking because we're right at the back of the park end, so we've got a really good view of everywhere. And you could just see what was happening and everyone ran over to that side. Michael Keane went charging over. I mean, you've got to go for the man with the ball. But Christ, you don't go that far if there's a player behind you. You've got to sort of go to some sort of in-between ground. They just legged it over, left Josh King in acres of space, I think it was. And that's just burned in my memory now. It's just some real horror show of this is how not to defend. But the way the players lost their heads was frightening. It's, you know, we saw it at Villa in that 10-minute spell. But in that game, we did actually regain a little bit of composure, I think, because that was, between 60 and 70 minutes? We did three, and we didn't concede six as we could have done. In that game, you just felt it. If the final whistle hadn't gone, he might have scored eight anyway because Pickford made a few saves. And that's what's really worrying me now. And that's why I think it's possibly the worst game I've ever been to because we shouldn't have been falling apart to a team like Watford. To be fair, Watford played better than us all game, but then teams have this season. And while you're winning, you get away with it, don't you? You think, do you know what? This is how we're playing. But to see Watford turn up and do that within 10 minutes, just shows, we talk a lot about lack of character, but there was none on that pitch on Saturday, and that's a real concern going into Wolves away.
Yeah, you know, I think in the past, Paul, I've not really been one to fully buy into this idea that it's all about leadership and characters. I've just sort of thought, well, we haven't got good enough players ultimately, and that's why we are where we are. But, you know, it was staring everyone in the face, wasn't it, on Saturday, that without Mina, who's probably our leader at the back, without Decore, who's obviously our leader in midfield, and you know, without Dominic Calvert-Lewin and Richarlison for long parts of the games, the character and the leadership wasn't there, was it? Everton fell to pieces.
Yeah, that's a fair point, Matt. I totally agree with what Les was saying there before about the whole performance. But yeah, I mean, the lack of leadership, particularly for some of the defensive aberrations that led to third, fourth and fifth goal, was crying out for somebody to be shouting orders, shouting instructions. I mean, looking at the, as I said, I watched it again before, Watford's fourth goal, I've never seen such a poorly defend a goal by a Premier League team in a long time. So we had three players chasing the ball on the edge of the area, Godfrey, Davies and Allen. All of them have the chance to clear it. None of them does. It ends up, I think, Godfrey kicking the ball, hits Allen, lands at the feet of a Watford player who passes through to Josh King, who should be offside, but Michael Keane decides to stay back in front of Pickford to keep him onside. Then Keane goes to make the tackle. Josh King sells him a brilliant dummy. You know, Keane's on his way to the corner flag by the time, you know, he's moved. And then just places the ball calmly with all the time in the world in the six-yard box. And then I look back to three people on the edge of the box who were in the initial tackle. And they're standing there watching. No one's made an effort to get back and try and rectify the situation. So, yeah, lack of leadership, lack of positional awareness. And I think there's a... Les alludes to this at the start. I mean, I think there's a real problem in terms of our defence. I mean, Digne just cannot tackle to save his life at the moment. Was lost possession and tackled so many times during the game. Ben Godfrey, since he's come back from COVID, he's just not the same player. He's making poor decisions. He's trying to use his pace to get us out of trouble. He's failing to do so. And Michael Keane, I never know what to expect from 1 week for the next time. Michael Keane, some weeks I watch him and think, this is a good centre half in the making. I think you can see why he's played for England. Other weeks you watch him and you think, well, why has he got no positional awareness? Why can't he pass the ball? Why can't he head the ball? So I think there's, you know, huge issues here for the Manchester team to sort out. And yeah, I know questions have been raised about zonal marking, but you can't put it all down to that. I mean, they must practice, well, I like to think they practice and rehearse these routines in training week in, week out. But, you know, Mina kind of come back quickly enough for me to try and stabilise that back four. And more, the decision to let Onkonku go out on loan, which means Dean has got no one challenging his position all season. I really failed to understand what the logic behind that was.
Yeah, just to pick up on your point there about the zonal mark, and I won't go into it too much. And Michael Keane as well, because we don't want a conversation. No one wants that.
It was almost like Les that Josh King had been training against this fella for six months and knew he's quite flat-footed. If you just set him a little dummy, he's just going to, you know, amble around like a lummox and not be able to get near the ball.
You've been taking notes, hadn't you? Definitely. Yeah. The worry with Michael Keane for me is you put him in as the sort of main man in defence. And he goes to bits. He can't seem to cope with the pressure of being the senior defender. When you've got Ben Godfrey or Mason Holgate next to him, it doesn't work, which is quite scary for a 28-year-old international. Just on the zonal marking, the problem I have with it is you're always susceptible to a goal like we conceded for the equaliser. Because defend, if you're marking space, fair enough, you're marking a zone, and if anyone comes into that zone, they're yours. But if someone runs into that zone, I don't know how you're meant to defend that, because you need to be touch tight to a man in the box, don't you? So they can't make that run. And if a big defender like that, or a big attacker, or anyone gets a run on you like that, you know, they can get that header in and score, which is exactly what they did about 5 minutes later, and he put it over. So it I think it's got to be a combination of two. Bit of common sense, really. You know, the players don't seem to take any responsibility on their own. The first thing you've got to do, you've got to check where the runners are coming from. You've got to check where the men are. And if you've got to walk out to a runner, maybe you've got to leave your zone. I don't know. But I think there's a lack of common sense and accountability in that defence as well.
And I think what happens with it as well, or what I think is an issue, if someone gets a flick on, then everyone's like, what do you do then? Just a zone. You know, you're meant to go to the man. And that's sort of what happened for the first goal. I remember being in the ground and Rondon, who's probably one of our biggest players, was on the post, the front post. Like, why aren't you in the box to head something away? And like, and then you'd see him try and jump for the ball, and you think, oh, actually, fair enough. Maybe that's why. But I think people sort of haven't spoken about the set pieces much because they were the first and second goal. And everyone's sort of been focusing on that third, fourth, and fifth goal and the shambles that were in that. But that's an issue for us to solve as well. And you know, just very quickly, Paul, you know, we spoke about the defence and how ropey they are, but you know, the midfield and the attackers can't get away with it either, because Tom Davis and Allen, I think, before the fourth or fifth goal, both completely bottled challenges. Rondon, as we've mentioned, is, you know, at this point, is probably a net negative on the team when he's on the pitch. I'm staggered that he's played 90 minutes for the past two games, to be completely honest. But I suppose we could sit here and say these players have been poor, that they're not good enough. But like you sort of said at the start, what can the manager do at this point? I think for me, Rondon's got to come out regardless. Stick anyone who can run at the top end of the pitch and we're getting an improvement. But the rest of the team, you're sort of going, there's not really anybody else to bring in here, is there?
No, I mean, since you mentioned Rondon there, I mean, I must have imagined this, but I stated this event on Saturday. I'll never leave before the end, no matter how bad it is. And 1 minute before the end of stoppage time, Rondon was given a yellow card. And I'm sure half the Glasgow were chanting, off. And no one's picked up in the newspaper reports or anything. And the last time I can remember Everton fans chanting that for their own player to be sent off was Bress Angel at QPR in 1994 or 95, I think it was. And, you know, this guy makes Bress Angel look good. And that's how worrying that is for me. And watching the Watford game as well, I mean, I'm sure you and Les thought the same. You look at the Josh King thing, why did we let him go on free in the summer and bring in Salomon Rondon instead? And that to me kind of summed up how abysmal at times our recruitment policy has been at the club. And the questions have to be asked, you know, why was our only option Rondon? And, you know, why is, if Lewis Dobber's on the bench, well, is he not worth throwing on for 10, 15, 20? How is he going to get, you know, big game experience by just sitting on the bench and coming off a minute or two? He can't offer any less options than what Rondon's offering at the moment. I think the only plus that came out of the game for me was Richarlison coming back, because you can see the massive difference he makes when he's back in the team. He gives the whole midfield and forwards a lick, gives the crowd a lift. As long as he stays fit, then you kind of think, you know, there's a slight element of hope that Mina's back for the Wolves game. That is also a plus as well. But
I think he's going to be back, apparently. So,
can't wait.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, well, Phil Kirkbride in the Echo said yesterday that he's got a worrying hamstring issue and he's probably not going to be involved.
Okay, well that's not quite the news we wanted to hear. But I'm midfield. I agree with what you said there. I thought Alan had put one of his worst games for Everton. Tom Davis, you wonder what happened to the player who 4 years ago scored that wonder goal against Man City. You wonder why he's not come on as a player, and you wonder why, you know, someone who's so obviously talented and who I think when he plays for the under-23s or did play for the under-23s, they rate him really highly for the leadership skills he brought to the side. Just seems to have gone backwards at Everton. It's a very depressing pitch at the moment.
Yeah, just to pick up on your Brett Angel comparison there, I've been thinking exactly the same. Hands down, the worst striker I've ever seen at Everton. 6'3", and he was about 5'11" when he jumped. He was the only footballer when he jumped. But Rondon doesn't jump. He doesn't seem to do anything. There's no use, no pace, there's no running, there's no anything, really. So yeah, the comparison is definitely there for me. They're like for the wooden spoon, now the worst striker I've ever seen. Davis and Allen, I think that game without Decore showed how much work Allen can work in a two. Because Tom Davis can't work in a two. He needs to be in a three. Same as Andre Gomez, he can work in a two. He needs to be in a three. I think Allen's the same as well without Decore. It does that much for that team that Alan can sort of get away with it a bit. But so that's what I think Monday night, I think we've gone out of 3-man midfield.
Yeah.
Only available options can work in a three. Not ideal, but I just think if we have a 2-man midfield, we'll just get overrun again. And I don't want to see Traore v Luka Dean.
That is terrifying actually, isn't it? Because I think he's had the better of Dean when Dean's been playing well. In the past. So, but just Dean, on Saturday, I've forgotten about all this, but the amount of times you just ran the ball out of play under no pressure, it's like, what are you doing? You're meant to be a competent Premier League footballer.
But even for Watford's first goal, because we set the upper bullens, and about 2 minutes before he gave away the free kick that led to the goal, he committed exactly the same tackle and giving away free kick, you know, in the same situation. So why he's done it twice, I just don't know. Because we've had this horrible feeling when that free kick was being taken, this is going to be a goal, and sadly it was.
It's just lazy. It's just lazy defending that. Instead of wanting to stay on your feet and stand your man up, you know, you're trying to win the ball back quickly, just diving in. But even when he's been playing well, he's had a habit of doing that, just making daft tackles. But yeah, dearie me. Just one bright spark, Anthony Gordon played pretty well, didn't he, Les? Hopefully this is the start of him sort of establishing himself as a genuine option in the first team now.
Yeah, hopefully. I mean, there was a bit of a kickoff in the park end by us.
That surprised me.
Oh yeah, imagine that. No, but like when someone kicked off when he got taken off and someone turned around and said, well, he hasn't really done anything, has he? I was just thinking, what do people want? He had a decent game. And I think, you know, just to go back to Walter Smith, he did bring, when he was first there, he did bring a lot of young players in. And I think we're going to have to do that now. I think, it's not ideal. You don't want to just throw the kids in. But I think when the when the options, you know, when you've got Anthony Gordon, who will play on the front foot, and he, you know, he has got that sort of youthful figure about him, really, whereby he will always try and attack. You know, and then you look at someone like Alex Iwobi, who's not actually that much older. He's only about 24, isn't he, himself? But he already looks so beleaguered and just wants to run across the pitch. To be fair, I don't think he's a wide player at all. I think that's why he always has the inclination to just run inside and just keep going right across the pitch. But yeah, I think with the options available, it's a case of needs must now. Just try something different. Unfortunately, Jarrod Branthwaite's injured as well, isn't he?
So I think he's back in training now.
Yeah, but another option.
Oh.
He could have been another option, but...
Yeah. Would you play Gordon on Monday, Paul?
Yeah, definitely. I thought he just brings a bit of brightness to the team. And I think because he's somewhat of an unknown quantity, I think he's got a slight advantage over defenders there. And you look at his involvement in the first goal. You know, the pace to start the move, the confidence to challenge their defenders. We need players like that are going to really defend this, create opportunities. So, yeah, you know, I'm just bemused why the manager seems to think he's not fit enough to play 90 minutes. I mean, you know, I'm not quite sure how he makes that judgment.
Yeah, that comment did annoy me. And it almost threw me phone at the wall when I saw that on Twitter. But yeah, we'll move on anyway, because yeah, pretty negative show all in all. But we're gonna have a nice little trip down memory lane now to some better days for this football club. The 1986-87 season, Everton's last title, and as Paul describes them in his new book, his wonderful new book, The Forgotten Champions. Paul, whenever I speak to people about books they've done, I always ask, you know, why this person, why this team, why this topic? But is yours quite self-explanatory with the title that this team has ultimately been a little bit forgotten?
Yeah, I think so, Matt. I mean, the idea came to me when I watched the Howard's Way film initially, and I thought, great film, but the 86-87 title champ got about, you know, a few minutes at the end. I thought, well, it actually deserves more than that, because when you think of the circumstances of that season, we start off the season with Neville Southall was missing till October, PCB was missing to more or less January. Paul Bracewell was out all season. Pat Van Den Howe was out to January. Guy Stevens was out to December. So effectively, 50% of the 84-85 side were missing for most of the season. On top of that, come to January, Graham Sharp is out to more or less the final game of the season. Kevin Sheedy is out to the last 3 or 4 games of the season. So I think Kendall was only ever able to field his first choice 11 about 2 or 3 games before the end of the season. Factor into that as well that we'd lost Gary Lineker to Barcelona. Factor into that as well that we'd lost the derby to them across the park. Not the derby, we'd lost the double to them across the park. We'd blown the league title by losing to Oxford United when it was in our hands. We'd blown the FA Cup final when we lead 1-0 with 30 minutes to go. And being an Everton fan that summer, one of the most depressing experiences of my life, when you had to put up with celebrating Klopp out, you'd won the double that we should have won by, because we were the best team that season. And so the whole season starts off under the clouds. And I still think to this day, it was Howard Kendall's best ever season as a manager. As you know, he brought in the likes of Kevin Langley, who played the first 16 games of the season. Although Kendall never wanted to start with the first team because he knew he wasn't quite ready, but he had no choices. He brought in Neil Adams from Stoke City, you know, a reasonable prospect, but he was never going to be an Everton great. And then he astounded the fan base by bringing in an aging 32-year-old veteran called Paul Power, who no one could understand why on earth he brought this guy to the club. And he ends up being voted by the supporters as our joint player of the season with Kevin Ratcliffe. He played 40 games non-stop for Everton, Paul Power. And he was an absolute revelation for the team. So somehow, I mean, when people bang on about the injuries we're suffering at the moment, I just go back to 86-87. Well, the injuries we had that season, somehow the manager was successful in getting a winning team out of that combination of players by good tactics. He brought in Dave Watson to bring some solidity to defence, and that was a tough call because Derek Manfield was an absolute hero amongst the Everton fans. But it just showed that as a manager, Kendall was at that time, you know, he was at the peak of his powers and he was absolutely ruthless when he needed to be. If he felt you were no longer any use to Everton, you went. He thought Andy Gray served his purpose, he sold him. He thought Derek Manfield had served his purpose, he brought in Dave Watson. So he had no qualms about moving players on if he felt it was the best way forward for the club. And some names I mentioned, I'm glad to see that Warren Aspinall, who made a few substitute appearances that season, is now going to be awarded a medal because you made five appearances that season. Apparently, the bar's gone down now for picking up your championship medal, which is really good to see. But there's been this perception that the 86-87 team was the dour team that ground out results. And at times they did because they had to, because they didn't have the full range of players to pick from. But over Christmas 86 and over Easter 87, some of the football that team played was some of the best football I've ever had the privilege to watch as an Everton fan. Paul Power described the 4-0 win at Newcastle United, and bearing in mind he played at the top level for like 14 seasons before he came to Goodison, so it was the best ever team performance he'd been involved in his entire football career, and that was some praise from such an experienced player to come up like that. And end of the season, last 12 games of the season, we won 10, we drew 1, we lost 1. I mean, that was some way to finish the season. We won the league by 9 points, and somehow this perception has come round that Liverpool blew the title. No, they didn't blow the title. We actually blew them. We blew them away. We put together that winning sequence toward the end of the season, and that's what gave us the title. We had the best defence in the league that season. We were the second highest scorers in the league that season. Built a great team to watch. If you go on YouTube, some of the goals from Kevin Sheedy that season, it's actually a masterclass of wondrous goals. From, you know, he argued by playing centre midfield a lot of the time that season, had his best ever campaign for Everton. And it's our last ever league title win at Goodison Park. And you have to think, you know, there's not going to be another one, is it, before it goes to Bramley Moor Dock? And the other thing about the title was as well, when we won the league at Norwich City, it wasn't on Match of the Day because BBC didn't have a Match of the Day highlights package that season. They only showed 7 live league games. It wasn't on ICV highlights because it was on a bank holiday Monday. So there was no coverage in highlights form on national TV of a team winning the English title on a bank holiday Monday anywhere. All you've got as a record is 1 minute, 15 seconds on ICV and BBC News of Everton winning the title in Norwich City. There's no DVD of that game of us winning the title. And I think of all the teams that won titles in the 80s, that 86-87 side, you know, there's no lasting record to how good they were. I mean, can you imagine now, you know, when the team wins the Premier League, you get like hours and hours of highlights, insights, documentaries about it. We got 1 minute, 15 seconds. It's just unbelievable. And then just when we thought we were on our way back up again, you know, we had the European ban again. So once for the second time in 3 seasons, we couldn't compete in Europe. You looked at the Everton team, we had, I would say, only 2 players were over the age of 25 at the time. There was Peter Reid and Neville Southall. Everyone else was under the age of 25. And we really thought we were set to dominate English football for years to come. And then Howard Kendall left. And we've only finished in the top 4 twice since. I mean, it's just, you know, the decline from being, you know, the best team in English football, the best team in Europe, to where we are now, has been bewildering to behold. And it's one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book, because I wanted to mark what a fantastic team that what this was, but also I wanted to record the decline since then. And also in the book as well, I want to give some insight into what it was like watching football in the 80s, because people kind of forget, you know, how bizarre our licensing laws were then. So on a Sunday, pubs were closed between 2 and 7. So if you had a Sunday afternoon game, you couldn't go for a drink after the match. You'd be outside the pub for 2 hours waiting for the doors to open. Absolutely bizarre.
And I'm not sure how fans would cope with that these days, with the way we're playing, yeah.
strange enough, guys, and I point this out in the book as well, it affected our Sunday attendances, because when we had the live game on Sunday, we played Manchester United. It was the first live game of Match of the Day that season. Our previous average against Man United had been about 42,000. We got 25,000 for that game on a Sunday. And I'm sure lots of that was down to, A, the economic situation on their side. People made the decision, well, I can't afford to go today, so I'll watch on TV instead. And B, the fact that people's match day routine was put out to sleep, because when the game finished, yeah, 4 to 5, you had nowhere to go to talk about the games. You had 2 hours to wait until the pub opened. So I just wanted to give an insight into that part of watching the game, and also into the joy of being an away fan at that time, because on a Saturday morning, you know, your mates are ringing up, Fancy going to Wednesday, Paul? Yeah, great. What time meet? I'll see you at 11 o'clock in the car park by so-and-so pub. You'd be there. You go down on mass. You hand over your money at the gate and you'd be in the ground. Not the security check, credit card check. Have you got the vouchers? All this sort of stuff. You just went. And you know, that part of the match going experience, it's just gone. And it would never come back again. And it was just, you know, the impetuosity of it when you just decide on that, yeah, let's go. Let's do it. You know, it's a real sad loss to football that you can't do that anymore.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, Les, what are your memories of that side? Because I suppose, you know, winning two titles in 3 years, they should go hand in hand, really, shouldn't they, in regards to, you know, that era and, you know, you say 85, 87, but there's so much focus on 85, and perhaps that comes because of, you know, what Everton did in Europe that season as well, but it feels as though they should be considered in tandem a little bit more, albeit the team and the personnel, as Paul mentioned there, were a little bit different.
Yeah, I think as Paul said, it's sort of like for half the season, we had like half a different team out. And none of these players were or became household Everton names. So that kind of shows how well the actual team did and how well Kendall did to gel that team, you know, playing a proper title charge. You can't underestimate the impact of 85, 86 either. I remember I've never felt so sick after a football match as that FA Cup final. I was 9 and I was in absolute bits about it. It was horrible. Because having blown the title to them, that was bad enough. And then you think, all right, we'll get some revenge. Was it? We'd already beat them twice that season, I think, hadn't we? In 80.
They beat us at Anfield 2-1. Because if you remember, towards the end of that season, sorry, it's 85-86. Sorry, guys, 86-86.
Yeah, 85-86.
85-86. They beat us 3-2 at Goodison Park, but we beat them 2-0 at Anfield. 2-0. Kevin Ratcliffe scored only his second ever goal for Everton that game, I think.
Squirmed under Grovelaar, didn't it? I remember the one.
It was a stunning volley,
I think. Yeah, you know, you can't really underestimate the impact that had. You know, the fact that Southall was missing was huge. You know, and there was a lot of factors there that built up to say, you know, we should never have won that title, and it was an amazing achievement by Howard Kendall. It puts me in mind a little bit of the '63 team. The fact that kind of gets overshadowed by the '66 and '70 teams. It's a similar sort of thing, and it is. It is quite strange that it doesn't get the recognition that it deserves, not just from Everton fans, but, you know, the fact that a cobbled together team effectively went and beat still a really, really good Liverpool team. I think that was a bit of a watershed for Liverpool because they went out and signed Beardsley and Barnes, and that, I think, the season after. So I think having that done to them, that definitely hurt them. Everton winning the title and taking it back off them that year. But yeah, not enough's made of it. And I think another reason for that will probably be because of the sort of the legacy after it, the fact that Howard Kendall did go to Bilbao, and the fact that the club again probably made the easy appointment and putting Colin Harvey in there. You can see the rationale behind it at the time, because Kendall's Everton really kicked off when Colin Harvey joined them as assistant manager. That was kind of the catalyst for Kendall's Everton to really kick on then. So it did make sense, the appointment, but it just didn't really work out. And I think it all sort of petered off. And the thing that blows my mind is that Everton were in a relegation scrap 7 years after winning that title. If you think from 1987 to 1994, the difference in the club, it's like two totally different clubs. And the Premier League was probably the worst thing that happened to Everton. We were a big part of getting the Premier League sorted, and we never really did anything to sort ourselves, you know, make ourselves ready for it. Really. So I think it all kind of goes hand in hand with that, really. My memories of it are a bit sketchy. The whole period's a little bit sketchy because, as I say, it was my first game when I was 7. I was 10 in 87. But I do remember beating Man City at home. But the standout from that season, Wayne Clark's goal at Arsenal when we beat them 1-0. I remember seeing it on the telly and I was just absolutely stunned by it. It is one of the best lobbed goals I think you will ever.
I was going to say, paint a picture of it.
It's so basically the ball goes back to John. Oh, is it a goal kick?
The ball's played back to John Lucas.
He kicks it, doesn't he? He kicks it, and it just sort of goes out to midway between the area and the halfway line. And Wayne Clark just hits this sublime chip right over John Lucas into the back of the net, and Everton won 1-0 that day. And he's another unsung player, unsung hero.
I spoke to Kevin Ratcliffe, you know, when I was doing the book, and he was saying that there were two players Neville Southall didn't like to face in training. One was obviously Kevin Seedy, The other one was Wayne Clark. And he said he hated facing Wayne Clark because he never knew when he was going to put the ball. He could look at his face. I have no idea where the ball was going to go. He'd either try to chip you or he'd fire it into the corner. So he was the other player who Southall really couldn't read what he was going to do with the ball. And you mentioned about Wayne Clark. I mean, that goal is fantastic. I would argue it's the best ever opening your account goal for Everton, because that was his first goal for Everton. And there's some way to score at Everton. Yeah, you know, it really was. And that weekend, Liverpool lost the following day at Tottenham. So suddenly the balance changed in our favour a little bit. It was a fantastic result for Everton that day. And better than that, at the time, Arsenal were pushed at the top as well. I think Arsenal beat us one of the goals early that season. So they were a really strong team. And what's quite bizarre is as well, before that game, Arsenal had signed Adam Smith from Leicester City, who was a really strong forward. And Kevin Ratcliffe always felt that Alan Smith was a better forward than Gary Lineker and wanted Howard to sign Smith and not Lineker. And for some bizarre reason, George Graham decided to loan Alan Smith back to Leicester for the rest of the season to help them stay up. So that was a massive boost for us, because I think if he'd been playing, it could have been a different outcome. You mentioned there as well, Les, about Liverpool that summer, and that's correct. I mean, they bought him. We were screaming, why aren't we buying Beardsley? We're the league champions. He'd be a great guy for us. I remember Harvey said in the summer, it's on the back of the Echo, we don't need anybody else. Now, Hal Kendall had never done that. He'd always bring in a different player in the summer. He'd always shake things up. So straight away, you're a bit worried how that was going to pan out. And the second thing was as well that by making Harvey the manager, I know Gavin Butler mentioned it a few times, we lost Harvey the coach. So Harvey was, his greatest skill he brought to that team was his coaching ability. He was now spending his time in the office doing a role he painfully didn't have the skill set for and really didn't want to do. We also lost Mick Heeson that summer, who decided not to stay on as well. So we went from having Kendall, Heeson, Harvey as the coaching staff to being replaced by Harvey's manager. And then the coaching replacements, which didn't really inspire Everton with any degree of confidence at all, were Mick Lyons and Teddy Daricott, neither of whom are associated with any glorious period in Everton's history. So straight away there, we were on the back foot. And then when you're looking for Harvey to make a signing, the first person he brings in the following season is Ian Wilson, a balding, aging 29-year-old from Leicester City, who even the players couldn't understand why he'd been bought. And the point you went to there as well, Les, I mean, Wayne Clark, was bought from a second division club. He was bought from Birmingham City. It wasn't a popular signing by fans at the time, particularly. We were looking for like Lee Chapman or somebody like that to join the side. So, but he came in and he scored six crucial goals for Everton on that title run. And it could be argued that without Wayne Clark's goals, we might not have got over the line. And some of the other, he bought in Ian Snowden in the January as well, because once again, once you realised Bracewell was not going to be fit for that season, he went and brought in Snowden. Those signings actually kept the momentum going because PCB was having an abysmal return to the side. He got his hair dyed black. I don't know if you remember that.
I think he just came in one day, didn't he? Black hair.
And I remember Bobby Robson commentating on Everton game at the time saying, PCB looks so young, I might pick him to go in the 23s next match with him. And apparently before the Arsenal game, Kendall said to PCB, look, I'm sorry, PCB, you've been playing so badly. I'm going to have to drop you. You've got to do something about this. And really took that on board and went out and played his normal game against Arsenal, because Adam Harper, who played 30 games that season, played in seven different positions for the side that season. I mean, the term utility man doesn't really exist anymore, but Harper played everywhere the manager wants him to. He scored three goals for the team that season, all of which were absolute stunners, particularly the one at Chelsea where we beat them 2-1. I think he played 37 times overall counting substitute appearances, and he was a vital cog of that team. He had his best ever season for Everton. And once again, he was a player who made about 10, 12 appearances in 84 and 85, but was the absolute vital cog of 86, 87 team as another unsung hero. And I kind of made a point with the cover of the book that got Wayne Clark on the front, because not many Everton fans, the name Wayne Clark doesn't mean a lot to younger generation of Everton fans. And I made sure on the back cover, Alan Harper was there once again, another player who played his role in Everton history. He came a bit of like a player Kendall would always go to, because he bought him again at Man City and then brought him back for the second time to Goodison. But he was a real unsung hero, but played a vital role in ensuring that we won the title. And people forget, we won the title by 9 points that season. We had it wrapped up with three games to go, and that was a fantastic achievement. And as you can probably guess, I always passionately believe that this side never, ever got the recognition, the credit, both from Everton fans and nationally as well.
I think maybe the club as well haven't probably done enough. You know, I think during lockdown they played that Norwich game, didn't they? The 1-0 where I think Pat Van Den Aal scored when we won the title. That was like the first time a lot of people had seen some of those plays and some of those names. But just a couple of points before we wrap up, because you know it's such a fascinating point. But as Paul said there, briefly touched upon how we thought this was Howard Kendall's best season as manager. Would you go along with that as well? You know, you look at the names that were absent, the context of 85, 86, the European ban, all of those things, you know. It felt as though there was so much stacked against them going into that campaign in regards to circumstances and injuries and maybe some players in that 85 side just getting a little bit past the best as well.
Yeah, 100%. I think if you look at like start of this season when, I don't know if it was the Atletico or someone did that, how confident are you for the coming season? And everyone were right down the bottom. I reckon if you'd have done it for that season, low down, because our morale would have been through the floor there. But yeah, as Paul said, you know, we finished, 9 points clear of Liverpool. And we were actually 15 points clear of Tottenham in third. So that shows the sort of dominance we had that season. If you go back to 85, 86, we finished 2 points behind Liverpool. That was us blowing it. That was definitely us blowing at that one. And even in 84, 85, we finished on 90 points, which I think was a record for years.
Yeah,
yeah. We were only 13 points ahead of Liverpool in that one. So if you look at like, you know, the sort of the way the team won that title against all the odds, because, you know, the start of the show, we were talking about the injury problems in this current team. They're not insurmountable. You know, I think Howard Kendall showed there that if you've got the right players and you can put them into a team that works, you can get through any sort of injury crisis, really. So, yeah, I think that's it's definitely something people sort of need to know more about. The club could do more about it, as you say. Everyone should definitely go and get Paul's book, because I will be up going.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And Paul, obviously, you said that you've spoken to a lot of the players for the book, and you know, maybe not so much people like Kevin Ratcliffe, who were involved in 85, and some of those other familiar names, but for the ones you mentioned in regards to like Harper and Wayne Clark and other players that were big parts of that season, but not necessarily 85. Is there any sort of, maybe bitterness isn't the right word, but is there any sort of angst from them and feelings from them and, you know, a little bit dissatisfaction from them that they're sort of a huge part of Everton's history, as you mentioned, the last title we won, probably the last title that we're ever going to win at Goodison Park. And they've sort of been, not airbrushed from history, but a little bit overlooked.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's business as such, man. I mean, I suppose Alan Harper would more power, because I wanted the perspective of someone who joined the club, who hadn't been in the club before, and someone who'd been around but never been a regular first team starter. So it was really interesting to get their perspectives on it. But no, Alan Harper, you know, is just full of praise for what the team did that season, and you know, kind of understands. You know, he does feel that, you know, when I spoke to him, that yeah, the title never got the recognition it deserves. So yeah, but maybe there's a slight element to that. Wayne Clark's a very doesn't really speak to people much. He's always been a bit of a loner, so he hasn't really given any thoughts about his view of that season. But speaking to Paul Powell was fascinating, because I wanted the insight of somebody who joined the club for the first time, and he kind of said, you know, during our conversations that, Howard Kendall was the best manager he'd ever worked for. Now, bearing in mind, this guy worked under Malcolm Allison, Billy McNeil, John Barn to a lesser extent, but you know, he trained under some pretty decent managers. He said what was great about Kendall was he could go into the dressing room, have a laugh and a joke with the players, but would never lose their respect. He then goes to the boardroom and be equally comfortable in telling the directors what he wanted, where to go. He could hand it to the directors. And then he'd come out and speak to the media, and he'd be equally as good with the media as well. So he had all the skill sets he required, you know, to be a successful manager. And, you know, have a Kendall's Chinese meals. You couldn't get away with it these days. But in the mid-80s, you know, it was just an essential part of team building. That, I remember Paul Power telling me that, when Wimbledon dumps out the cup 3-1 the fifth round, but that was another real bad low point that was. And when the team got back to Liverpool and the players got off, Kendall just said, "Mr. Lowes, 12 o'clock tomorrow, be there or find your week's wages." Now, Paul Power suspected a week of punishing training, which would be the normal reaction of Man City. He didn't quite understand what was going on here. But you know, they all went to Mr. Lowes' Chinese. All the drinks were paid for by the fines the players are paid during the season. The drinks flowed. Howard had his customary bottle of champagne. Fingers were pointed, you know, voices were raised, discussions were had, But by the end of it, the team had bonded together again. They let off steam. They got out of the system. And that from that Chinese meal onwards, they then went on that second winning sequence that won them the league. So those tactics you couldn't get away with anymore, I don't think. And I think as well, look, have Kendall. When we won the league in 87, he was 40. So by the age of 40, he'd won two league titles, an FA Cup, a European Cup, Winners' Cup. He was undoubtedly the best manager in England and Europe at the time. And his managerial career kind of reflected his playing career to some extent, because he won the league with Everton when he was 25, never won another thing. Won one of those titles as a manager before he was 40, never won another thing. And it's just a really interesting parallel to figure out why that would be. And I got contacted by, I don't quite know how this came about, but I got contacted by a journalist from Bilbao who'd seen about the book and wanted to speak to me about Howard Kendall. And we had a great conversation about how well-respected and thought of is in Bilbao, how he lived in the team's training camp for 2 years, how the public really took to him. And although he was sacked in his third season, they were really, really sad to see him go. And then they said, Bilbao, because of Howard Kendall, have real strong affection for Everton, and it's their real hope that one day, and it could be a long way away yet, we have to meet each other in Europe and have a thing to commemorate Harry Kendall's link between the two sides.
Yeah, he's really highly thought of over there. I was trying to find it then. There's a cracking article on it, on his time in Bilbao. It might be in The Guardian. I'm not sure. He's really, really well thought of over there.
Well, when you think that's what I mean, bearing in mind that the Basque Country, Athletic Bilbao, you can only play players born in the Basque Country.
Yeah.
You can't go out and buy a big foreign star. And so he was restricted by that. And that season when he joined Bilbao, they'd been at La Liga, then she's like a relegation playoff season where the bottom 16s all played off to see who would go down. Bilbao were in that group. Within 12 months, he got them into Europe. And you kind of contrast his first season at Bilbao with Harvey's first season at Goodison. And the comparisons are favourable in terms of where Everton were compared to where Bilbao were.
Yeah. Just one more thing, sorry, Matt, on the title win. The optics of it were very nice because we got the old Division One Championship trophy back. So when we were 85, we had that horrible Cannon League that looked like a minus.
Oh, yeah.
But that was today sponsored the 87 league, didn't it? So there was also this hexagonal glass trophy that was there as well. I think it's, if you go on the stadium tour, you get to see it. It's a really weird, horrible little trophy. But
it's
finally get to parade that Division One title round again. And that's what you see on the pictures, and it looks ace.
And going back to that, Les, I mean, it's not a claim to, well, the two subsequent bits of this, well, I'll cover this in the book, that Everton, when we first won the league at Anfield, were the first team to actually be given a trophy for winning the Football League, because the previous winners, Preston North End, were given a certificate, and the third season of the Football League's club voted to have a trophy given. So we were the first team to actually be given silverware for winning the league title. Secondly, we're still to this day, and it can never be taken away from us, we're the only winners of the Today Football League trophy.
There you go. That should be on the Goodison timeline or on the ground. stick it on there. Oh, God. Just when you were talking about the Chinese, then it made me think that Rafa just needs to get this lad into Maggie Foo's in town for the afternoon, and everything will be sold ahead of that Wolves game. But no, wonderful stuff. If anyone wants to get that book, the link is in the description. If you listen to this on podcast, if you're watching this on YouTube, just scroll down and you'll be able to find it. Paul, links are all over your Twitter as well, aren't they? And it's in Waterstones in town, so they sold out to people, but they're restocking.
Yeah, it's available in Waterstones. They're down to the last four copies on Tuesday, but there are a few more. Pritchard and Crosby ordered quite a few copies as well. I did a book sign there with Graham Shaw, so Pritchard and Crosby have it. You can get it from Pitch Publishing. Obviously, it's available on Amazon as well. I'm looking to try and get it on sale in St. Luke's before the game, before Christmas. So, yeah, there's plenty of avenues to get it. But, if there's a blue in your life who needs, some lifting from the despondency, buy the book for them, because it'll just bring back memories of what was a fantastic season and still our last ever title at Goodison Park.
Yeah, perfect Christmas present, absolutely, for any Evertonian. So, yeah, scroll down to the description or the caption for your podcast or video, and you'll be able to find it there as well. But wonderful chat. You're so lucky, lads. You don't know how lucky you were saying that. I've had nothing but pain and suffering in my life as a Blue. But no, that's all we've got time for this week. Cheers to Les. Cheers to Paul. That has been the Blue Room. We've got mailbag tomorrow. Me and Les are going to be on that. More levity, hopefully, at the end of a pretty downbeat week. And of course, we'll have post-match and everything else on Monday. And I've also got Lindsay Hooper on from the Offside Rule podcast, speaking about Wolves. And that's your weekend preview on Blue Room Extra tomorrow as well. So cheers for tuning in today. We'll speak to you again very soon.
Northern Tool and Equipment isn't just a store. It's a problem solver's paradise. Fully stocked with the right professional grade tools and fully staffed with experts who have the right answers. Problem solved.
Northern Tool and Equipment Summer Sale is on now. Stop in and save up to 50% on pressure washers, sprayers, generators, fans, lawn and garden equipment, and more. Hundreds of deals in store or at northerntool.com.
Sports Social Podcast Network.